Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Hey, podcast listeners. Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreenews. That's amazon.com/adfreenews to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air. I'm exhausted today. How are you feeling, Alex?
Why are you... What a way to start off the podcast. You know, I'm ready to say happy Wednesday. Welcome all. Thank you for your questions. And you're just like setting the tone from your sleepiness from the get-go. Why? Yeah. Why are you so tired?
No, it's just I landed at 1 a.m. yesterday. Took me an hour to get back. So it's... Yeah, and then, you know, I have to get up early to record the podcast on a Wednesday morning.
Just to let everybody know.
That's the only thing I would get up
for. It is by no means early. It is 10:50 in the morning. Oh, my God. We said we were going to discuss what you did to me on Friday morning, but we'll get to that. Okay,
no, let's get to it straight away.
Well, let's. I don't know why you're sounding so confident. You were in the wrong.
So Alex texts me on Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. his time with some news. And I just want to discuss it. I don't want to just text. So I call him and Alex is
right,
outraged.
Pause. So Friday in the Middle East is a weekend, right?
Not Friday. Not in the whole Middle East.
Sorry. Friday in much of the Gulf part of the Middle East is a weekend, all right? The UAE and other places being the exception. But for example, Qatar, Friday and Saturday is the weekend. That's how it is in many places. So yeah, I sent Dan, you know, a nice piece of news from one of the networks at 8:30 in the morning because, you know, I'm up and I see it and I forward it to him. That is not an open invitation to call me at 8:30 on a Friday. How dare he? I was horrified when I saw his name. I said to him, this better be good.
Listen, if you text someone, that means you're available to call unless you say otherwise. Like, I'm in a meeting and I'm sneakily texting you. Otherwise, it's fine to call in my book. So anyway, we had a nice conversation, didn't we, at 8:30 a.m.?
No,
your
it
voice
was outrageous.
Was all raspy
it was
and morning.
Yeah, okay. Morning voice. Yeah, because again, you were calling on a weekend at 8:30. See, I should have just pressed decline, right? It was in the interest of everyone. Instead, I answered and I said to you, "How dare you?" And then go ahead. What do you have to tell me? And you're like, oh, "I just want to chat." I'm like, "What the? This is no, okay, absolutely not." And the fact that you think I should have covered myself by saying, "Hey, Dan, here's a link of, you know, piece of news, but don't call me because," and a whole list of reasons, you're sick, seriously.
Anyway, I have some great stories from the past few days, which are the reason I'm tired. I've been all over Europe. I mean, I flew to and from Europe, but then I traveled around in Europe. And I, for like the second time in 2 weeks, I took one of the first morning departures from Heathrow. So you remember a couple of weeks ago, I flew BA to Rome.
Yep.
This time I flew BA to Amsterdam, and guess which gate I had?
See, at this point, I would like to sincerely thank my friends at British Airways for once again assigning him gate Alpha 10. That's the bus gate that I put in as a request every time Dan flies. Thank you to the chief executive's office, to those that work for him, and to the valuable staff members of British Airways for doing that for me. It comforts and warms my heart that Dan is on a bus at 5:30 in the morning being shuttled to an A320. Am I right?
A319.
Oh my God, they really did pull out all the stops.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't have like scripted it better, because I was like, yeah, you know, last time was Rome, this time it's Amsterdam. There's no way this can also be a bus gate. We just joked about this. It's not going to happen. I get to the airport. Of course, the gate was not announced. One interesting thing I noticed is that every gate that was announced, and actually, so I'm just checking a photo I took here of like the first 30 minutes of departures. Every single flight, I see Barcelona, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Madrid, Brussels, Newcastle, all B and C gates.
Yes, that first wave very often is. I think I've told you before, like if I do that first Malaga flight, it's almost always now a B or a C gate. And of course, they have to publish the gate very early on the flight information boards in order for passengers to take it seriously and get going, because it's so far. Maybe they underestimate the journey. Also, did you notice how typically when those flights open for boarding, within seconds it switches to flight closing just to make people go?
Interesting. So why do they do that? I mean, to me, the obvious explanation is that the A gates are very busy in the morning when they have a bunch of European departures at like 7 a.m. But yeah, many long-haul flights are landing at 7, 7:30, 8. So they can put all the earliest short-haul flights at those wide-body gates, at the C and B gates, and then they leave and a wide-body pulls in. So
That's exactly what happens.
Yeah. So at that point, I'm like, all right, well, my gate isn't showing yet, so it must be an A gate. Good for me. Then I go to the lounge and I go, oh, and they have to reprint my boarding pass. And then I'm like, tunnel vision on the gate as I see A10. And I'm just like, this cannot be real. And of course, again, it wasn't one of those gates that's right next to the terminal. It was by Terminal 3 again.
Beautiful. So beautiful. Beautiful. Beautiful British Airways. Yeah, that's great.
Well, anyway, I had a great crew. They were super friendly and casual and
landed. How long was your flight?
45 minutes. Super, super quick and fun. Okay. We landed on the Polderbahn, which is, I think that's the name, right? Of the runway that's really, really far from the airport in Amsterdam. And if you've ever landed there, it's quite fun because you're just landing among fields. And then you slowly taxi. Actually, you taxi very fast, but the progress is very slow of getting to the airport. And pretty much every flight ends up taxiing for about 20 minutes from the landing runway to the terminal.
Which is also a bit of a feeling, because when I have done that, I'm always thinking, this is as long as the flight.
Yeah, from London. It's literally
from London. Yes, 50%. I'm like, we have been on the aircraft now for as much time as we were airborne, except we're still not at the gate. So it is an idea. That's not ideal when you're coming from somewhere so close. But I can accept it when. Where was I coming from? Somewhere in Africa, and I flew KLM.
Oh, maybe Rwanda or something.
Maybe coming back from Rwanda.
No,
I think that was Brussels. Anyway, it was somewhere. And like that, it's kind of okay. But from London, it's a bit, oh God, makes you feel stupid for flying.
I mean, I have to say that Schiphol Airport is very fun. Besides that thing, all the runways in kind of intersecting, and there's maintenance on one of the runways right now, which is leading to some delays. But they've made it into a whole thing. So they've built like a platform where you can go and watch the construction. That to me is so Schiphol, because it's like one of the plane spotting airports in the world. Yeah. And one thing I forgot to say is, we talk about sometimes amazing British Airways pilots. This flight had those pilots who want to give you every little update that only us av geeks appreciate, you know? Everyone else is like, why are you talking on and on and on? But, you know, he had to give every detail about our altitude, our speed, the runway number we're departing on and landing on. And then, you know, as we got to the gate, he had to sincerely apologize that we pulled in 2 minutes late due to the exceedingly long taxi in Amsterdam. So, yeah, it was all quite a bit of fun.
I saw on Twitter recently, actually, I think it was just yesterday, a British Airways pilot PA bingo. And it's a bingo card that you can have for when listening to the pilot's PA. And it has all of the quotes that they all say, I guess almost like across the board, because I think I've heard every single one. One of them is that in the PA, they'll say, just the last bits and pieces of paperwork to finish off.
Yes. That's
that one. Okay. The other one is, thank you all for boarding so promptly. also a quick mention of the British Airways seatbelt policy about keeping the seatbelts fastened. And when they finally arrive at the gate at the other end, a quick PA that says, well, here we are, we have I read these and I was thinking,
I love it.
That is the language of the BA pilot. You're fluent, I guess, after a few years.
I really love that. Anyway, have you been to Amsterdam in the past few years?
It's been a while. Actually, I haven't been to Amsterdam since the pandemic. So it's funny, isn't it? That's how we always like consider time now. So where it feels only like a few years ago, I'm thinking, well, the pandemic started 4 years ago this month. So, so it was 2019 was the last time I was in Amsterdam.
Okay. I mean, it's such a beautiful place, like genuinely, but it is so shocking walking around the center of town and seeing all the overly sexual things everywhere, seeing the coffee shops that obviously people go to for other things than coffee. It's just like, and the ads also, like, you know, you travel in Asia, the Middle East, and sometimes you get back to Europe and you're like, this is a billboard in front of the, you know, everyone passes this, old, young, male, female, everyone. And it's like people in the most scantily clad, like, girls in some bikini ad. And you're just like, whoa. I'm almost like, have I become conservative to the point where I'm like, this is a bit much. Can we tone it down?
I think maybe you have become jarring. Because we've spoken about that before, haven't we? I think the more time that you spend out of, for example, like the more time you spend in the Middle East or in some parts of Asia and so on, I don't know. I do, because I remember speaking to you about this very thing, that there are certain European cities we go to and I'm like, my God, you know, did they get dressed this morning? And I don't know if I would have had that same remark like 8 years ago. Yeah. So it's funny.
It just used to be normal, but I feel like now you just, you react to things more strongly when you see it out of context. And oh my God, I think there are more British lads in Amsterdam than there are in the entire UK.
But they don't want them there, do they?
No.
They were launching different campaigns to stop the, in the UK it's called a stag do, which is the equivalent to an American bachelor party.
Yeah.
They were launching different campaigns to kind of stop this because they basically did a discouragement campaign. So it wasn't a ban, but it was kind of this campaign that was focusing on the fact that if you are young British and want a messy weekend, go somewhere else. That was the motive of the campaign.
Yeah, and it does make sense, because living somewhere where there are so many people who just come to like mess around cannot be fun. And it is interesting with places. So they're discouraging that type of tourism. Of course, we've also spoken about how the government is trying to limit the number of flights. So although tourism is obviously a huge part of the Dutch economy, there's several steps on several different levels for sustainability or for, you know, to help the local environment in other ways than just pollution as well, going on in the Netherlands. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and that was, so the Netherlands had this bizarre tweet, didn't they? Or Amsterdam Airport, Schiphol rather, had that bizarre tweet when the government had said that the cap that they had proposed on limiting flights at the airport was actually no longer going to be implemented when they had previously outlined, which you think the airport would have celebrated, but instead they were saying, this is very bad news. And everyone yeah. was like, huh? You don't want growth? You're yeah. opposing your own economic, you know, prosperity hopes? I mean, it was a little bit bizarre, but they have their own motives for seemingly wanting to appear absolutely aligned with the state's climate change goals rather than their own goals of, you know, growth aspirations and so on.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of Amsterdam and those limitations, one airline that was going to be limited or impacted by it was JetBlue. But yeah. now that those restrictions were removed, JetBlue can continue serving Amsterdam this summer. But that brings us to some nice news about JetBlue's just announced shakeup, if you will, of their network. Because we've spoken here before as well about JetBlue and Spirit's merger being called off, Spirit Airlines being probably the closest equivalent to Ryanair, or maybe that's Frontier, but one of the closer equivalents to Ryanair in the U.S. They were going to merge with JetBlue, but that was called off. And now JetBlue yeah. is trying to find ways to survive and return to profitability. So as part of that, they've announced all types of cuts, including pulling out of most of their destinations in South America. So that includes Bogota, Lima, Quito. They're also greatly reducing service to a place that breaks my heart. They're cutting a lot of routes to LA, Alex.
I saw this. And you know, this is it's not so often that we see airlines take drastic action to do this like financial tidy up. We very rarely see that tidy up take place. But this is JetBlue, as you say, emerging now, leaving behind the extremely costly, what ended up being a bit of a mess with the whole Spirit merger that now is not going ahead. And also them trying to focus on stronger markets after years of losing money in different places. Plus, don't forget, they're having to ground some of their aircraft, just like Wizz Air and many other operators around the world, because they have Pratt & Whitney engines. So this is going to help them there. They, as you said, a lot of South America going, even Lima, Peru, which, you know, I was a bit surprised at, because these are hubs, but there we go. They're out, pulling out as well. Kansas City, Missouri or Missouri, and different routes from Los Angeles, which is devastating, including Seattle. So, you know, yeah, the Boeing link there,
San Francisco, Miami.
Vegas, Miami, yeah. ending flights between Fort Lauderdale and Atlanta, Austin, Nashville, New Orleans, yeah. Salt Lake City, and even service between New York and Detroit. It's, you know, it's unusual that we see a sledgehammer taken to a route network anywhere, yes. let alone on an airline that is as nimble and as agile as JetBlue, you know?
Yeah, but thank you for giving that context, because that's exactly the point. It's so rare for an airline to just be like, okay, we're just going to cancel like 20, 30 routes today. We're announcing it.
Yeah.
You know, that's a huge deal. And I guess maybe we should discuss partly why this is happening. For example, why are they pulling out of LAX? LAX is a really difficult airport for airlines to compete in for a few different reasons. First of all, it's one of the only cities in the U.S. And, you know, comparing it to New York, where you have two long-haul airports, Newark and JFK, and LAX, you have one, and you have all three big U.S. carriers, American, Delta, and United, offering hubs there. So they're flying long haul and trying to compete with each other. So right. there's already brand loyalty fierce to these three airlines. Southwest also has a huge presence at LAX. So there's just so much competition from brands that have a ton of loyalty. And JetBlue is really a small player on the West Coast. So for them to be able to compete, it has to be on price. They're not offering Mint on most of these routes besides their LAX to Miami, which is being cut. So, you know, it's just not a favorable position for them to be in. And what's so interesting is that even if they wanted to grow at LAX, it's not really possible, because so many airports in the US, although they're massive compared to many other parts of the world,
yeah.
are pretty restricted in terms of slots, and specifically at LAX, gate space is a huge problem. Even though they have over 150 gates, which might not sound like a lot, but Atlanta, the world's busiest airport, only has about 190. So LAX is not that far behind. But even there, it's impossible for JetBlue to get more gates and hence compete more effectively with other airlines.
Good context. And it's true. You know, they've been able to recognize where their strengths and weaknesses are. And it's very rare, as we said, for an airline to be forthcoming about that and to not, you know, overthink or just operate endlessly to places that are simply not profitable. But JetBlue have to do this now. They have suffered with the losses, not least because of the losses incurred by the deal that has been killed by the Biden administration with Spirit. And so now is the time to aspire towards financial health again. And most airlines, remember, around the world are making more money right now than they have ever made. Never mind just since the pandemic, but in history, we're seeing record profits everywhere. And that is the way in which the travel resurgence kind of occurred after the pandemic. But it's also the way in which, you know, demand has solidified now across the board rather than just localized or in key areas. And airlines are expanding, they're reinvesting. We're seeing forward investments everywhere, which is a nice link into some other news that occurred over the last week. We have many questions about this, and I trust many of the listeners knew that we were going to be covering it. But here in Doha, Qatar Airways Group CEO, Badr Al-Mir, if you remember, he is the gentleman that took over the seat of Akbar Al-Bakr in November last year, so just months ago. He was formerly the top of Hamad International Airport. That was very much his baby in terms of the expansion, the orchard, and everything that came with that expansion. It wasn't just the area itself, but it was the fuel farm, it was the new baggage handling facility, it was the gates, the remote stands, and so on and so on. He's now at the top of Qatar Airways. He sits down with CNBC just a few days ago for his first ever global TV interview, and he came with the goods. He has announced a new Q suite, an updated version of the existing world's best business class, widely considered, which is going to be revealed at Farnborough. So that's not too far away at all. There's also a new first class coming. So he has publicly committed to first class, which is a U-turn from the previous CEO. Badr Al-Mir told CNBC that he sees there is a demand for it. He was citing the fact that they always have, you know, premium demand on certain routes where first class absolutely makes sense. I mean, I think we can both agree there that, for example, Dan, on a London flight now on the A380s, first is a given that there it would at least be. So how many seats do you have? You have 8 seats currently on an A380 in first. I think on almost every flight, minimum of 6 of them are occupied.
Yeah, that's amazing. I find it interesting that so many airlines are so intent on cutting first class, because when I check, there's many routes where first class does really, really well. Not to mention that premium demand is just increasing and increasing. Flying long-haul first class is still way cheaper than chartering a private jet. So to me, it's like, I mean, I think we all wish they would keep it around. So this is really exciting news.
And if one airline home market specifically has a demand for first class, just like the other Gulf states, it's Qatar. I mean, you have London as one of the most favored or the most favored route of the Qatari market, for example. Now, they only make up less than 5% of travelers on their own national airline, but the overwhelming majority are premium travelers. They are flying in business and in first class cabins. So places like London, Paris, of course it makes sense. So it's an interesting development that he had said he is publicly and, you know, confirmed to be committed to first. There is a new first class cabin in the works. It's going to debut on the incoming new aircraft that are on order already. So that suggests it's initially going to be on the new Boeing 777X aircraft that are currently on order from Qatar Airways. We don't have an exact timeline, but he was very forthcoming with this interview. And for that, I think we're going to be hearing a lot more from him there. And the headline of the interview, of course, he has released an RFP. So that's essentially a request for a proposal where you go to the manufacturers and you say, come to me with your best proposed package for a large aircraft order from both Airbus and Boeing. So now Airbus and Boeing have to put together their best proposals, and ultimately one of the manufacturers will win a large aircraft order from Qatar Airways. Almir ending this interview by confirming that this is not simply Qatar Airways anymore. This is Qatar Airways 2.0, which was really interesting to mark a kind of new era. Interestingly, the full interview isn't out yet. All of that was just a few clips. The full interview is out next week. So that will be interesting to see, you know, with context, how these conversations came about.
Yeah. So what is your prediction for the big aircraft order, if you had to give one?
I think that there is a likely scenario whereby it could be split between both. I just think that history has taught us that it's sensible if you're able to hedge your bets with both. At the same time, there is a chance that they will just go with the better offer, and it's whoever can offer that better offer. And I think,
where they need to give a better offer, no?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, there are reasons why Boeing may secure that order, because perhaps there are greater discounts involved, maybe, given the climate that Boeing is facing right now. Perhaps Airbus order is perceived to be a little more reliable, maybe. Maybe they're able to, you know, in the way in which their relationship has now resumed with Qatar Airways and, of course, a new leadership, maybe that will play a role in terms of what Airbus is able to offer. Don't forget, Qatar Airways is still waiting to receive some A350s, but also A321 aircraft. They're going to be LRs, the long-range variant. Of course, on the Boeing side, it's got 777X on order. So it's not like either of the two manufacturers emerge as a clear winner at the moment. I would say quite the opposite. It's really anyone's game, and it's in their interest to put together the best proposal for the new group chief executive to make that decision on with his board members, and hopefully something we can be announcing on the podcast very soon.
Yeah, there was quite an interesting comment, just a small one made in passing during the interview, that I was like, this is quite indicative, because he said at one point that Airbus had basically called him up and said, hey, we have two earlier delivery slots for A350s. So remember, obviously, infamously, there was quite a bit of bad blood there between Airbus and Qatar with the A350. Their orders ended up being canceled, then reinstated, but for several years down the line. But now, apparently, Airbus has offered, at least for two of them, to push it forward a bit and offer earlier slots, which I guess is good news for Qatar.
It was interesting, and I think that was when he was pressed in the interview, wasn't he, on the relationship with suppliers, and he was just trying to demonstrate that there is always that open dialogue. Now, many airline CEOs go on TV and say this, but as you say, he gave a real-world example. He said, for example, Airbus just communicated to us that some aircraft are able to be delivered earlier than we thought, you know, which is great. And that was that kind of example of how, you know, it's a dynamic relationship always between the manufacturer and the airline. Also, he noted, and he was quite clear, where he wanted to expand. And Dan Murphy, the CNBC presenter who was anchoring the interview, he pressed him specifically on this, and he said, okay, that's where you want to expand, but where do you want to expand today, if you could expand right now? And Badr Almir, the CEO, said China, India, Australia, Japan, Korea, and a few others, which I also thought was really interesting, because China, of course, you know, pretty much closed for most of the last few years. And now, of course, a place with always solid demand, QR wanting capacity there. India, everybody wants capacity to India. India is quite protectionist, as we know. It's not so open in terms of having open skies. Australia, is this going to be a new era of the relationship between Qatar Airways and Australia, given the recent complications where Australia denied it without reason, denied Qatar's expansion? Remember, we spoke about it on a previous episode. And then Japan and Korea, who are not, you know, they're not famous, if you like, in the industry for being protectionist, but I can see why there would be room for growth. Those flights do very well. I mean, what did you think? Were you surprised to see that ultimately Europe wasn't on there when he said, you know, where do you want to expand right now?
I guess your demand is being quite adequately met in Europe, besides to Gothenburg, of course. But I will say I was surprised that he said China, because Emirates was serving China, Beijing and Shanghai, and maybe Guangzhou with A380s, but they removed them for the spring season. I'm not sure if they're going to, I'm just checking now. Actually, they won't even be serving China in the summer with A380s. So that to me says, all right, Emirates is decreasing capacity, but somehow Qatar Airways sees there is so much demand that they want to increase it. I guess that could come down to, you know, I'm just checking the route map now from Dubai to China. I'd say there's service to almost 10 cities or maybe even more, maybe a dozen cities in China direct from Dubai on all types of Chinese carriers. So I guess the competition is much stronger there versus Qatar Airways mainly focusing on connections when it comes to Chinese passengers. And I guess it's just a completely, it's tough to compare Emirates and Qatar sometimes because the target demographic can actually be quite different depending on the route.
Yeah. And speaking of competition, let's actually play you a clip directly from the interview where Badr Almir was specifically asked about competition on Riyadh Air. This is the, of course, the Saudi newcomer that hasn't launched yet, but is always perceived and portrayed to be this kind of threat to the other Middle East airlines, despite the fact it doesn't exist at the moment. And of course, you remember we interviewed the CEO, Tony Douglas. Let's hear what Badr Almir had to say when they asked if Riyadh Air is a threat.
When it comes to Riyadh, as well, we welcome competition, but we don't feel pressured from Riyadh being a new player in the market. You know, we have established our company for many, many years. We have established our base when it comes to our customers. We have loyal customers that will always fly Qatar Airways and will not accept to fly with anybody else. And the number of clients, loyal clients, keep growing. So for me, the way I see it, pressure is on Riyadh Air to come in a market where they will have to compete with the best of the best. There's no pressure on us.
That's an interesting spin on where the pressure is lying. I mean, we heard Tony Douglas on our podcast say that they are primarily focusing on passengers to and from Saudi Arabia. They're not trying to be a hub connector. So,
but did we believe that? Did we believe that? Let's be honest.
Well, no, they're obviously going to rely on connecting traffic, but
absolutely. It's going to form the core fundamentals of their business, whether he says that right now or not. I mean, there is no demand for point-to-point Saudi Arabia that justifies a big global airline at the moment. Yes, they have big growth ambitions, as we said. But I think what Badr said is correct in that the pressure is very much on them. We always keep, you know, Emirates and Qatar Airways and Etihad, they keep being asked, oh, what about that? Riyadh Air, you know, coming up. It's like, well, this is an airline coming into play with the heaviest of global aviation giants, you know?
Yeah. And these airlines have had years, decades to build their brands, to build trust. Meanwhile, you have Saudi Arabia trying to build trust, but Riyadh Air will definitely have an uphill battle compared to, you know, I think Qatar and Emirates and Etihad can sort of lean back and watch it unfold. They all have great products. So for now, I wouldn't be sweating it too much.
Yeah. We've had this just brings me to something we were speaking about in terms of how we measure demand and how you and I can perceive demand by ourselves. I've had about 4 or 5 messages via Instagram from a variety of different people who have asked, how is it that we are able to refer to how busy a flight is? Mm-hmm. So they're asking, how do we know? So, for example, one guy said, hey, you mentioned how Etihad flights to London, you know, in the morning are still half empty. He said, I'm just curious how you know that. Then there was another guy, he's a diplomat in an embassy in Warsaw, and he asked the same kind of thing. How is it that we are able to say with accuracy as to how busy a flight is? So do you want to explain how we know?
Well, there are a few different ways. There are websites where you can check. For example, anyone can use expertflyer.com. And if you get a premium membership, you can basically check how many seats are available for sale on pretty much any flight and airline. It doesn't really work for low-cost carriers, but anything else, you can see how many seats are left in each fare class, and then you can also check the seat map. I think what Alex and I do most, I can spend a full afternoon just for fun checking seat maps. So, for example, one thing I love about United and the United app is that you can check flight status of pretty much any flight that they operate 2 days in the past, currently in the air, and even 1 day ahead. And there you can see the seat maps of every single flight. So I can go through like the entire departure wave from Newark in an in one evening on the United app to check the loads of the flights as they are in flight. So you can see very accurate representations on the seat map. The same goes for Qatar Airways. You can view their seat maps until the minute the flight is scheduled to depart. So those types of things give great indications on what the loads are. And, you know, I remember during COVID.
And it's really helpful.
I just have to say, I remember during COVID, like checking, that was when I really opened my eyes to this because I would check like 1 minute before departure and I would be like, is there something wrong with this? Or why is every single seat empty? You know, those are some crazy moments.
Yeah, so you can have you can get a really accurate idea as to how busy the flight is based on how many tickets are being sold and how full the flight is in terms of seat allocation and so on. So it's kind of taking both pieces of that data. It's also really helpful. I'm like Dan, I can be sitting on an aircraft refreshing until I know that the last person has boarded, because I can figure out if the seat next to me, for example, is going to stay vacant or not.
Yeah.
And the system is updating in real time. It's probably the best. Isn't it $5 a month or something?
Yeah. I think it's maybe $50, or maybe it's $100 a year for Expert Flyer, actually. But you can check seat maps for free. It's just that I think you're limited to like 5 searches a day or something, which pales in comparison to how many I can sometimes do.
Well, I don't sit there for fun checking other random flights. I mean, I would do it to take an idea of something that I'm investigating or flying myself. But we've spoken previously about how Dan spares his spare time.
Excuse me.
And that's not a subject we need to revisit.
Excuse me.
Sorry, Dan, if you have any queries or any follow-up to that, you can call me again at 8:30 a.m. on a Friday, perhaps, and see if I answer this time.
That is 100% research, okay? And next time I'm doing it, I will call you whatever time of day when I realize, all right, United is operating a 777-300 between Brussels and Washington, D.C. I wonder how well they can fill that in a February.
I see, oh wow,
it is quite full. You should care because it reflects on supply and demand pretty accurately.
I do care. It's just when you said, you know, United, I was like, oh. we need to discuss. No, United, we spoke in depth about last week, and this week they've actually had to come forward. You remember that list I went through last week on last week's episode?
Yeah.
Well, this week the United CEO has come forward to reassure their staff that, like, everything's fine. Do not worry. These are just headlines. You know, this is the normal working activity of an airline in terms of having the odd maintenance mishap here and there.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing thing. But there wasn't much to update since we were pretty ahead of the game going through that long list during the Q&A last week.
Exactly. Do you, because I posted a short and a reel about this, and people have all types of different theories. You know, people love to get political about why this is happening. I think the explanation is pretty clear, but do you think there's, you know, any obvious explanation to why? Actually, their explanation isn't so clear as to why it's only United, but
yeah,
in general,
I have no answer to that part as to why it's only United. I know why Boeing's reputation is in tatters right now in terms of, you know, the public awareness. I'm seeing it everywhere. And you've got key people discussing how, oh, Boeing are facing a crisis. And then they talk about something isolated that happened, you know, at one airline on one day in one circumstance a week ago, as if it's a Boeing problem, when 9 times out of 10, I mean, if there was a higher ratio, I'd go for it, but 9 times out of 10, it's not a Boeing issue. They are simply linking anything that happens with a Boeing aircraft now globally. Remember, there are over 12,000 flights in the commercial air travel world per day. Anything that happens globally that involves a Boeing, which makes up, I mean, half of the world's aircraft fleet, if not a little bit more, there are over 10,000 Boeing aircraft in service, with the current issues that Boeing is facing, which actually are to do with production quality issues that we've spoken in depth about. That is not a sensible link to make. And that is the link that most of the media is making. And that's why we're getting messages from cousins and relatives far and wide saying, hey, you know, is it all right that I'm flying on a 737, you know, an ordinary 737 tomorrow, when they've always flown a 737, never thought about it. And now they're questioning it because they're just seeing Boeing, Boeing, Boeing. And you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts. Even some of the podcasts that are my usuals, I haven't been able to listen to because I'm thinking you are linking two things that are not supposed to be linked. A 787 that has been in service for 8 years and has, for example, an oil leak has nothing to do with Boeing quality issues in Seattle or in South Carolina and so on.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And I think that, you know, the reason it's partly that United is getting so much media attention because of the Boeing thing that makes people be like, what's going on at United? Then, of course, United does have an older fleet. It has one of the oldest fleets in the world. It is true. Also one of the biggest airlines in the world. So combine all those factors, there are going to be incidents. But if we just look at how they've been handled, everything has been handled incredibly well. No one has even been injured. So, you know, you need to take one step at a time when it comes to this and see that United is still an incredibly safe airline. It's just that now is a bad time to be having any sort of incident because every airline is under a microscope.
And imagine we knew it was, you know, terrible for you, Dan, to eat chocolate, right? And you eat chocolate throughout the day, all the time, but nobody cares. But then suddenly it's a trend that, you know, the whole world knows Dan's not supposed to eat chocolate. So then suddenly we start getting alerts every time you eat chocolate. And so suddenly it appears on the surface that you are eating so much chocolate, despite you not supposed to be eating chocolate, when actually you're still eating chocolate at the same rate you were previously. The difference is we were not reporting on it previously.
Yeah.
That's what's happening right now. And, you know, and I hope you're enjoying your chocolate because I like chocolate. So.
I feel like you're talking about yourself because I know like 50% of what you eat is chocolate.
It's not 50% of what I eat. How dare you?
It's
75,
sorry.
No, it's not. I eat a very, very well-balanced variety of breakfast, brunch, lunch, dinner, and so on. In addition to all of that, God, I love chocolate. Specifically, Swiss chocolate. Mm. Love it.
Have you seen Wonka?
No, still I haven't seen it.
I
didn't
skeptical.
See it because I starred as the main character. So
people say you look like Timothée Chalamet. No, they don't.
Well, I mean, a few people sent it to me when Wonka first came out. But
okay, by the way, I saw Dune 2. Great movie. Also, you should check that out in IMAX.
Do I need to see Dune 1?
No, you don't. We went with Oscar's mom. She had not seen Dune 1, and she enjoyed Dune 2. Dune 2 was so much better, in my opinion. So
because Oscar's mom liked it, I will.
No, I mean, I'm pretty sure yes, because out of all people to like it, someone who has not seen part one, someone who couldn't care less about that type of stuff. But yeah, just make sure you watch it in IMAX. I also watched Wonka, and I was like, that was about a couple of months ago, but I was so skeptical. And it is kind of a children's movie, but sometimes I love a good children's movie where the plot is very simple and you can just sort of enjoy it for what it is. So...
Did you see what Miriam Margulies, the woman, the lady from who was in Harry Potter, did you see what she said this week about how anyone who is an adult right now should not like or should just let go of Harry Potter because it's for kids? And she's like angered the Harry Potter world.
Who is this?
Yes. She's a very, very, very funny actress, comedian. She's Australian, but she's mostly in the UK. Miriam Margulies, you would recognize her.
I'm Googling.
She is always on late night talk shows making blunders and swearing and, you know, just doing naughty things that she shouldn't be doing. But she has urged adult Harry Potter fans to grow up, and Harry Potter fans are outraged by this. But
do
you
like
Harry
Potter?
I have never seen a single Harry Potter movie ever.
Get out.
I know.
Why?
Everyone is always saying, I don't know. I've just never seen it. I read the first book when I was a kid, which was Philosopher's Stone, right? Yeah. So I read the first book, but I have never seen any of the movies. And You know when this always comes up? For example, the last time I was with the delegation from Philippine Airlines, right? These lovely team of Filipinas, they were all, oh, your accent, oh, Harry Potter. And I was like, they said, oh, you must be obsessed with it, or, you know, stereotyping, right? And I said, I've never seen it. They were like, what?
Yeah. Alex, that is illegal for a Brit to not have seen Harry Potter. It's, why would you not ever have watched it? It's on so many airlines.
It's on so many airlines, and every single time I see it, I think, not today, another day. Like, you know, like, because I just, I don't know. And you know when someone tells you, you have to watch it, that voice in the back of your head makes a note, a mental note of, right, I must do my best to avoid that movie.
Somehow. Okay, so that's how you've been with Veep all this time. Now I get it.
No, I sat and watched the first episode of Veep last week, by the way. Okay. It's on OSN last week. Yeah. It's only a 20-minute episode, isn't it? Also,
yeah.
So something like that, yeah.
Not a commitment like Harry Potter, but...
No, and I only watched one episode.
The fact you were... yeah, thank you. But the fact you were outraged by me not having been to Disneyland and you have not even seen Harry Potter.
I know.
This is jail.
Disney's amazing. I mean, the roller coaster, Space Mountain, Thunder Mountain...
Guess what? Harry Potter is amazing too. I am an adult and I like Harry Potter, okay?
Well, that explains a lot to me.
That actress can sit down.
Okay. And with that, let's sit down for some Q&A.
Let's do it. Okay. So Dan asks, what is wrong with Alex for not having seen Harry Potter? I agree.
Liar.
Next question. Okay, here's a question from, I only see the username, I guess it's Kesh. Can we talk about the prospects for the A380? It seems like multiple airlines are now reinvesting in fresh business class seats. So are airlines now committed to it for the longer term?
I think the picture is still split, isn't it, between those that are committed and those that are not. I think those that were not committed to the A380 have already got rid of them and are in the process of getting rid of them. So I think the A380s that you see around today are pretty much here to stay. Emirates, definitely here to stay. They're practically drowning in them. Qatar Airways, the CEO confirmed in the CNBC interview that we spoke about that they are now here to stay for the foreseeable, at least until new aircraft from Airbus and Boeing arrive. British Airways are going to be launching a new first class on their A380, which means they are reinvesting.
Lufthansa and business.
Lufthansa are introducing new cabins on the A380 as well. God knows when, because the timeline is all over the place. God knows if it's upstairs and downstairs, or downstairs only and upstairs and so on, because that's also been a development. So with that, I would say that many of the main A380 players that you have seen around today are airlines that are committing to them. That doesn't mean they're reinvesting, but it means that they're going to stick around for a bit longer. What do you think?
Yeah, it's those few airlines. It's about a handful. Singapore Airlines, Qantas, Lufthansa, British Airways, Emirates, that I feel are truly committed to the aircraft. Lufthansa now is truly committed to it. Etihad, I feel, is a bit like, never know where they're going to go, if they're suddenly going to be like, we're bringing back all our other A380s, or if they're happy with just a few. Qatar Airways, I feel, he said they're going to stay around, but watch the first 777X get delivered, and I think that spells the end for the Qatar Airways.
Well, he said he was quite, I disagree. He was very detailed in explaining in the interview how the A380 can achieve what other airline jets simply cannot in terms of operations to congested airports like Heathrow. He said the only way that we can fly more passengers in is on aircraft like the A380, and no other airline jet does that in terms of capacity. So he said he likes it, he's committed to it, and when they kind of pressed on, okay, but until when, he said until we're in a position where we no longer need them. So I would disagree. I don't think it's going to be the first, but I think once there is a solid new fleet of wide bodies, like, you know, a solid new fleet of 777X, if it ever gets certified, and other aircraft, then I think then we would see the transition out of the fleet. But I don't think it's so I think that's sticking around for longer than you think, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to play devil's advocate a bit. I feel like he says that, but then Qatar Airways is still sending like A350-900s to Heathrow. So yes, capacity, the A380 unlocks capacity, but it's not like they're maximizing capacity on many of the frequencies in relation to what they could. While Etihad sometimes now has four daily A380s to London. So, you know, Emirates, of course, the smallest plane they have, 777-300.
Qatar operate two to London a day.
Yeah.
So Etihad four. And then I guess the other A380s are flying basically to Australia.
Yes. Yeah. For now.
For now. Yeah.
And then, yeah. So I feel like, you know, British Airways, also the thing that airlines need to understand, which I, you know, got to give it to Carsten Spohr. He says it like it is, very transparently, about the A380, that it draws passengers in every single cabin. You see it's an A380. People are willing to pay a bit extra to fly an A380 over something else for the additional comfort. And, you know, the airlines that aren't seeing that benefit perhaps aren't marketing the benefits of the A380 well enough, because we both agree it's such an incredible aircraft to fly as a passenger in any cabin. Now, many airlines have slightly outdated cabins, but look at Singapore Airlines, look at Emirates. It's just such a joy to fly, and airlines could do more to capitalize on it because it is a special plane that deserves to be around as long as possible, in my opinion.
I agree wholeheartedly.
I have a question here from Moritz. He asks, this is interesting, speaking on the subject of Ryanair from previous episodes, what do you think would be the smarter strategy for airlines? Being strict on the maximum allowable measurements of hand luggage, but liberal on weight, like BA, he says, or vice versa, being strict on the weight, but liberal on the size, like Emirates. I guess this is in his experience. What are our thoughts?
I think it's more sensible to implement measures on the size rather than on the weight, because I think realistically, most passengers are not bringing on board cabin bags that are weighing more than 10 kg.
Yeah.
So I just think that it's not something that is an industry problem. What is an industry problem is if you've ever flown on an Italian flight and they board with about 15 bags. That's a problem.
Yeah, be strict on the quantity, maybe.
Yeah.
And not having like something that's ridiculously sized. I wouldn't say airlines should specifically measure or weigh carry-ons, because look, if you have one piece of carry-on luggage, as you said, it can only weigh so much. Most people are not filling their carry-ons with gold bars. There's clothes and there's maybe a laptop and some other stuff in there. There's liquid restrictions, which mean people can't, you know, bring huge, heavy things anyway. So what happens when there's a weight limit, people just end up checking that in instead, putting it in their checked luggage, you know, having to add a checked bag. So it's not benefiting the airline in any real way. By restricting the size and number of pieces, they can make boarding more effective. It eliminates a lot of problems in that sense.
Yeah, I agree. Xavier asks, and I hope I've pronounced his name correctly. Apologies if I haven't. He says, enjoying the podcast so much, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts when it comes to bidding for an upgrade. What would you think is a good bid to upgrade from economy to premium economy on a transatlantic flight from New York to London? That's an interesting one.
So $200, I would say.
So that's so funny. So in my head, I was thinking $250.
Yeah.
So we're aligned. Yeah.
$200, $250. Like, I would say that to premium economy, and then $500 to $600 to business is about the going rate.
Let us know how you get on. Let us know if that secures you your upgrade. I have a question here that is from, let's see, I have a question here that is from Jan. He says, hi, Alex, I'm a huge fan of your podcast and Dan's. Oh, so it's mine.
I love that we have separate podcasts.
Yep. No, I think he's very smart how he's written it. I think he recognizes there's a host and a co-host. Anyway, he says, I'm a huge fan. Let it go. Okay, you called me on Friday morning at 8:30. You are in no position to talk. He says, I'm a huge fan of your podcast and Dan's, and I thoroughly enjoy every episode. I have a question regarding the current state of airline capacities. It's evident that airfare costs have skyrocketed due to significant demand, but it seems that airlines still have a considerable number of planes not in operation, a holdover from the pandemic era, if I'm not mistaken. Could you shed some light on why airlines haven't returned all available aircraft to service to capitalize on current demand and potentially moderate ticket prices? Thank you for providing some insights on this and for the outstanding work you and Dan continue to do. Sending cheers from Sydney. Cheers to you in Sydney. Thanks you for a great question. Well, that's a very interesting one. Let's look at Etihad. They are a prime example of an airline that are still umming and ahhing about their A380s, but at the same time speaking about demand.
Yeah.
So you have the capacity. In fact, you have the aircraft with the most capacity on earth sitting there. Why not do something with it? What do you think the reasons are behind that?
I mean, the first airline that came to my mind with this question is Cathay Pacific, that still has so many grounded aircraft making really high profits for the first time since years before COVID even.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a way of controlling supply and demand and controlling price, in my opinion. Of course, they can greatly increase capacity if they want, but for any business, it's about finding that sweet spot where you're not, you know, offering too much, so you have to charge less, but you're offering that perfect amount where you can maximize your revenue. That's ultimately what it's about.
Yeah. And a lot of the time, many of those airlines, because of the way in which they are building back their profits, some I have seen are pretty reluctant to start paying for the heavy, heavy maintenance that many of these jets require. And so it's something that they're putting off. You know, they know that they can get by with other aircraft. And so maybe they're not paying for the heaviest maintenance check to begin on an aircraft that has been grounded since 2020. And it's something that they're putting off. I think that's true to some carriers. I mean, look at the number of aircraft that are still on the ground in Bangkok with Thai Airways, yeah, for example. It's, you know, and they're just not in a position to even begin addressing those. They have started, but come on, it's 2024, we're approaching summer, and it still looks like an aircraft boneyard when you land at Bangkok.
Yeah, but I think we just have to look at it like this. Airlines are... The pandemic was kind of like a shakeout. It let them remove most things and start from scratch. So
true.
Comparing it to prior to the pandemic, for example, looking at Cathay Pacific, you can't just look at that and see why are they not doing the same thing. Well, because they were unprofitable. Same with Etihad, for example. So better, in my opinion, to slowly increase and see, all right, where can we go that makes sense? Where can we progress and still make profits, rather than just be like, all right, let's go at 100%. So yeah, their flights might be full, but they still need to proceed with caution to maintain the new delicate profitability that these airlines have managed to achieve.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's quickly, that brings us on to the last question of the episode. It's from Marco. He says, hey, Alex, continuing to love the podcast. As fellow lovers of Oneworld, I wanted to know what your and Dan's thoughts are on Cathay Pacific and what specifically your thoughts on the recent teaser of the Aria suite. Keep up the amazing work. He says, P.S. I work for Stansted Airport, so if there's anything I can do to stop you shuddering at the thought of us, let me know.
No way. Wow.
Oh, Marco. Yeah, I already feel better about Stansted. Thank you for your message.
I'm amazed that Marco still listens, considering how many times you have spoken ill of Stansted.
Well, at least I'm real and I have done it on the podcast. Heaven forbid they knew what you say off the podcast. Anyway,
what
answer the
are
question.
You making up? I haven't
answer
been to
the question. The
so
Aria
long.
Suite. Aria Suite at Cathay. What do you think?
I mean, listen, a few years ago, this would have been so, so exciting.
Impressive.
But
yeah.
These days, an
it's
airline
right.
announcing. Yeah. I mean, these days, an airline announcing a reverse herringbone with a door
so
is
Cathay.
Like, okay. Another
thank
one.
Thank you, next.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
It's kind of that.
I agree. Well, look, we're going to get to more of your questions next week. I'm also conscious that, didn't I read out a list of names last week of the questions that I will get to this week? And I don't think I did them because I've put them in a separate folder. So if you're in this list of names, I'm now going to go back and make sure, okay, we're going to get to them. I think also we will be, well, I'll discuss this with you in a minute, Dan, off the podcast, but I'm thinking we do an entire episode of only Q&A. So that way you can get in touch with us. Let's do it for next week, okay? We might do a tiny bit of headliney things depending on how the news agenda goes, but we are going to dedicate almost the entire episode to Q&A. So this is your chance. Send in your scenarios, not just your questions. Send in your moral scenarios, your dilemmas. Were you in the right when you told the lady with the baby that she can't have your window seat because you had pre-booked it? We're going to tell you if you're right or not. Let us know your thoughts of, you know, are you planning your summer travels and you're concerned about A or B? Are you wondering where you should be investing your shares in either manufacturers?
We will not be answering this.
Basically, come to us with your Q&A. We're going to get to that list of names I said. We're going to get to those that we didn't get to this week. And we're going to get to even more of you as we're going to dedicate. And as wide ranging, the better. If you have questions about something that's happening where you live in Peru or in LA or in Gothenburg. No, sorry, Gothenburg's not allowed. Get in touch with us and we're gonna get to it. And with that, I think we sign off on today's episode. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, guys. We will see you next week on air. Bye-bye.
See you later.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Alo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/try.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown and your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah.
All for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle. Available at your neighborhood Tim Hortons. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.